You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, controversial research into a deadly strain of bird flu is starting back up at UW-Madison. We'll get the details from the associate editor of WisContext. First, have you ever had your house tested for radon? If not, you may want to consider having that done before the winter is over. Radon is a naturally occurring toxic gas commonly found in the soil around Wisconsin. In fact, it's the second leading cause of lung cancer after smoking. You can't see it, smell it, or taste it, and it can show up in any building, including homes, workplaces, and schools. While that might sound scary, our guest has some steps you can take to protect yourself, and she's here to take your questions about radon at 800-642-1234. Have you tested your home for radon? How worried are you about it where you live? What do you want to know about radon exposure, testing, or mitigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica Maloney is the Indoor Air and Radon Program Manager for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Jess, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's great to get coverage on this important topic that we're always trying to get people to be more aware of. So,
tell us a little more about radon, what it is, and why we worry about it.
Well, it's exactly like you said. It's a colorless, odorless gas that comes from uranium deposits in the soil. It's a radioactive gas, and it enters buildings basically anywhere it has ground contact. So the slab and little cracks in your foundation, sump cracks, utility lines, again, basically anywhere it has ground contact. And we're concerned about it because it is the second leading cause of lung cancer and the leading cause for lung cancer in non-smokers. And lung cancer is one of those diseases, not that you want to get any disease, but very low survival rate for lung cancer.
And are there parts of the state that have more or less radon risk?
Well, Wisconsin in general, 1 in 10 homes has an elevated radon level, we've been finding. And we do see areas of Wisconsin more in the north central Wisconsin, Fox Valley, La Crosse area, but we're finding it more and more the more test results we get back. So we just really encourage everybody to test because that's really the only way you can know. You can speculate on geology level, on geology in the area, but your neighbor can have elevated radon and yours can be fine. It's just how your home sits on that deposit.
And we'll get into how we test in just a moment, but I understand that we might want to do it soon and not wait until the summer to test. Why is that?
Well, we have been telling people that winter is the best time to test because that's when your house is most closed up and you're going to have that sort of worst case scenario. But the summertime, you can still test in the summer. You just want to have your windows and doors closed for the time period that you're putting that test kit out. But overall, radon levels do fluctuate. They go up and down based on weather patterns, how you're using your home, whether the doors are open or closed, windows are open or closed, fans are on, heating, that whole thing.
And how do we test? What do we do?
An individual homeowner can do a test themselves. You can purchase one at a hardware store, or you can purchase one from a radon information center, which we have 17 of them in Wisconsin, and they're operated out of local health departments statewide. And you can find a radon information center by going to our website at lowradon.org. And they serve the entire state. And these test kits are what they call activated charcoal test kits that we give out, but there are different kinds of test kits. But typically, you just take it out of the package, put it in the lowest lived-in level of your home, and make sure that when you put it out, you put it out for the adequate number of days. Typically, a short-term test is anywhere from 48 to 72 hours. Or you can do a long-term test kit, which is a minimum of, I believe, 90 days, and that can be in place for a year.
Talk about radon, radon testing, and what to do if we detect radon. We'll get into that in a few moments. Jessica Maloney is with us from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Palmyra. Scott, hello.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Scott?
Okay, I'm curious to know if you have a home that's built on a slab versus a home that has a basement. is it still a concern, and should you still check for radon?
Yeah, absolutely. You should. Just because you don't have a basement doesn't mean that it can't possibly get into those cracks and crevices from anywhere that home has ground contact. Also, too, if you have a crawl space, still could be a problem.
Thanks for the call, Scott. We'll go now to Harold on the line in Superior. Harold, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. I live in Superior. And I've wondered for years and years. I know at one time, years ago, I went on some website and I found a map of the intensities or whatever of radon found in certain areas. Like I have a daughter, North Branch, I think that was kind of high there, and the son up by Pike Lake, and I think he was in a low area. I think Superior was in a low area. But the bottom question is how many people that have had deaths in Superior, and of those, how many have found radon?
Harold, thanks a lot for the call. Do we know in the Superior area how tests are coming back? I don't know if you have a map in front of you right now.
Well, I don't have the map in front of me, but again, you can go to our webpage at lowradon.org, and right on that main splash page is an interactive map where you can look that information up right there. You can look it up by zip code, by larger area, and it'll tell you how many test kits have been performed in that area and what the levels we're seeing are. But again, maps can be kind of deceiving in that they give you a general idea of what the results are in the area. But again, the only way your home and how to know whether your home has elevated radon is for you to test.
Right. So you're saying, thanks a lot for that call, Harold, and good luck figuring that out. Just because we look at a map and it says, oh, other people have tested don't have radon, it doesn't mean we can clap our hands together and say, great, I don't have a problem.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we do like to give people a picture of what we're seeing in the state. But again, yeah, you're not out of the woods until you put that test kit in.
So suppose we test and we find we are at that elevated level high enough to worry about it. Then what? What can we do to deal with that?
Typically, we recommend if people have done one short-term test that they test it again just to be sure that the results are accurate, because sometimes things can kind of get a little bit messed up in the lab, or you get some sort of a strange anomaly. But if you have an elevated result, we encourage you to contact a certified radon professional, and we can find those as well on our state webpage at lowradon.org. And those professionals will come in and take a look at your house and talk about putting in a mitigation system.
And that's, I was looking at diagrams, that involves some kind of venting thing where it vents those gases that are seeping up out our rooftop, right?
Yeah, typically a mitigation system is they drill a hole in your basement slab and they attach some piping to it with a fan that draws the gas from below your slab of your home, and then put a fan on it, and then it vents it out into the outside air.
Now, let's say we test, and yay, good news, we have low radon levels this time. Okay, now this is me. Can I ignore the problem, never think about it again?
We typically recommend if you've gotten a low level that you test it again every couple of years, between 2 to 5 years is the range. Just because radon levels fluctuate, your home changes, it settles, maybe you put an addition on, and that changes the way your home operates as well.
Now, also people sometimes come out in a middle range, and is that a case where, as with the high range, you retest them?
For sure. And just because the number is 4 picocuries per liter doesn't mean that we're not seeing health risks in between or near that level. I mean, 4 isn't necessarily magic.
And this isn't a substance where, we've got radon levels high, don't go in the basement, steer clear. It's not something that's bad today, it's bad with that prolonged exposure, right?
Right. And we're talking about lung cancer is a later stage of life disease. So, staying out of the basement, not necessarily the best option. So, but, you know, you want to take care of your exposure over the course of your entire life.
And I saw, and I think it was on the state website, this is the number two leading cause of lung cancer. The number one, of course, smoking. Mm-hmm. And combining the two really particularly bad, radon and smoking.
Yep, absolutely. It's got a synergistic effect, I guess, is what you could call it. And it amplifies your risk of lung cancer, I believe, tenfold.
So briefly, as we wrap up, your hope is to get the word out about radon. A quick recommendation for our listeners who haven't thought about this.
Test your home. Fix it if you have an elevated result over 4 picocuries per liter. It could save yours, a friend's, or a family member's life.
We'll leave it there. Jess, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Jessica Maloney is the Indoor Air and Radon Program Manager for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We talked with her about the dangers of radon and what we can do to protect ourselves from it at home. Coming up, we'll hear about a controversial bird flu research at UW-Madison that supporters say could lead to important breakthroughs in our understanding of the virus, but critics worry it could be more danger than it's worth. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the week's big stories in national politics, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi coming out against impeaching President Trump and Milwaukee being named host to the 2020 Democratic National Convention. First, research into a deadly strain of bird flu at UW-Madison kicked off a fierce debate in the scientific community 8 years ago. Backers of the program said it could mean huge steps forward in our understanding of the way the influenza virus works and spreads. But opponents said it was too risky and could inadvertently start the outbreak it's looking to stop. Now, after some years of public meetings and risk-benefit analysis, that research has gotten the green light to continue. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. You can find his latest piece on this flu research. It's online over at wiscontext.org. Will, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the actual research that's so controversial here. What are UW researchers trying to do?
They are looking at a strain of flu called H5N1. And what they did in 2011, several years ago, was they showed that in just 4 mutations, this strain of flu that normally affects birds, but can sometimes infect humans, they made it transmissible between ferrets, which is a common stand-in for human transmission in labs. So that raised some red flags among some people, some scientists and people in the public.
And let's remind people kind of my mission in life. When we say flu, when we say influenza, it's not stomach flu. It's this respiratory ailment of various degrees of severity.
Right. Yeah, definitely. It's the influenza A. It's a strain of influenza A, which, yeah, is a respiratory illness. Which can sometimes make small children vomit, but no, it's very different from the stomach flu. And in particular, this one, it's an avian influenza. So, yeah, as I mentioned, it's primarily affects birds. It's actually been a big problem in regions of Asia, where a lot of poultry farms have dealt with it, a lot of dead chickens, and it can be deadly in humans as well, but it doesn't. It's not transmissible really between humans.
Right. There's a good news, bad news when it comes to this H5N1. It sounds like bad news, it is lethal. Like if we get it, it's really, really dangerous. But as you say, it's not something that at the current time tends to spread to humans often or among humans very often.
Exactly. The people who tend to come down with it are people who have close contact with birds, often people who work on poultry farms. But yeah, it's lethal up to 60% of the time. So that's a lot higher than your run-of-the-mill influenza that's going around every year, which is still packs a punch often.
Before we get into concerns about the research going on here in Wisconsin, it seems clear what the goals would be. We want, what, an early warning system. We want to figure out what it would take to have this lethal form of flu become pandemic among humans.
Exactly. What Dr. Kowoka showed in 2011 was that in just a few genetic mutations, this type of influenza, the H5N1, that is not normally transmissible among mammals, became transmissible among mammals. And that's something that could happen in the wild as well. Influenza is a quickly evolving virus. And so it can pick up genetic mutations quite readily. And so, yeah, they're looking to provide some sort of early warning detection system, and also to try to figure out new vaccines, antivirals, treatments for H5N1.
Now, this is something that could mutate in the wild on its own. But what's going on in this research is they are, in effect, forcing it. They're making it mutate to see how few steps it would take to get there. That's where this starts to get a little controversial, right?
Exactly. And it was a subject of fierce debate when this was first announced in 2011. Should say that there is also a group in the Netherlands who did very similar work right at the same time. Both Dr. Kowoka's paper and the group in the Netherlands, their paper, they actually delayed the publication of their papers because there was concern that if they described the process for making this deadly form of flu transmissible among mammals, maybe it could be used by bad actors to develop some sort of bioweapon. But that they did publish the paper, that hasn't happened. But there are still a lot of concerns among some scientists that making a deadly form of flu transmissible among mammals is not really the way to go about trying to protect against the next flu pandemic.
We're talking to Will Cushman from WisConText about research going on here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, looking at very deadly strains of influenza, modifying them to see what it would take to make them transmissible among humans. Well, let's talk more about the concerns here. Sometimes when there's a scientists are doing a thing and people are worried, it's the lay people. Maybe they understand, maybe they don't know what's going on. This is coming from within the similar research community as the people doing the research, right?
Right. Yeah. These are other infectious disease researchers who are raising this concern. I spoke to Mark Lipsitch. He's the director of the Center for Communicable Disease Research at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And he's been a longtime critic of this line of research. His contention is that if there were to be some sort of unfortunate lab accident where maybe a lab worker became infected with this H5N1 flu that could transmit between mammals, that could lead to a health crisis or potentially a global pandemic, the precise thing that these researchers are really attempting to keep at bay.
And in this period since 2011, when this development was announced, there have been questions over federal funding, right, for this kind of research. What has happened over that time?
Right, yeah. So in 2014, there were a series of lab accidents at federal research facilities at the CDC involving deadly pathogens. I should stress that none of this was involving Dr. Kowoka's research, but it raised concerns about the type of research that Dr. Kowoka does in that a deadly, dangerous pathogen, if there were an accident, as I said before, at a lab that studies it and it gets out, it could potentially cause a lot of problems. So the federal government, seeing that there is maybe some more oversight that needed to happen, placed a moratorium on research like Dr. Kowoka's beginning in 2014, which they lifted at the end of 2017 after a three-year, fairly public, lengthy deliberative process assessing the risks and benefits of the research and really making sure that the safety protocols that are in place are effective.
And you talked to spokespeople for the project about that issue, what kind of security and safety are in place. What did they say?
Right. So the lab where this work is set to resume is in Madison's University Research Park. It's it's in a facility that's rated, it's a biosafety level 3 agriculture, which is one half step below the kind of like highest safety biosafety rating that the CDC has for labs. So it's got some really stringent security measures. There are a lot of alarms. People who work there have to pass an FBI background check, and they have to use protective equipment. And also there's like the local fire departments have been instructed that if there's a fire at this research facility to just let it burn. And if someone has a medical emergency while they're working at the lab, they have to be decontaminated by a qualified lab staff member before they can receive emergency treatment. So it's pretty intense.
And one of the critics you mentioned earlier also raised concerns about the transparency over the approval process to get, I think it was the federal funding in this case. Can you talk about that?
Right. Yeah. Dr. Lipsitch at Harvard said that from his perspective, the the review by the Department of Health and Human Services, which includes NIH, which is funding this research through one of its institutes, he said that from his perspective, it lacked quite a bit of transparency. He said that it was less transparent than a normal grant review. He pointed to the fact that the folks who were reviewing this proposal were not named, which he told me is kind of standard operating procedure for such a grant review. And when I spoke to representatives at the Department of Health and Human Services, they told me that because the people who reviewed this research in advance of greenlighting it were federal employees, that there was no risk of any types of conflicts of interest or anything like that. But they declined to tell me who the reviewers were.
So there's been this back and forth over funding and the review procedure. What's happening now? Is the research just going on as it had been originally?
Well, I'm not sure if it started yet. I know as of early February, when Science Magazine first broke the story that this research got greenlighted again, at that time they said that it could be starting in the next few weeks. So it very well could be starting right now. I know that Dr. Kowal is currently out of the country, but or at least he was earlier this week. I'm not sure about now or when exactly it'll get started, but we're expecting it to start soon, if not now.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He was with us to talk about controversial research on a deadly strain of bird flu that's resuming at UW-Madison. You could read Will's coverage on that over at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Milwaukee will host the Democratic National Convention in 2020. We'll talk about the strategy behind that decision during our weekly roundup of national politics, plus a look at some of the latest in Congress, including an expected vote in the Senate on the president's emergency declaration at the U.S. border, and talk from the Speaker of the House, the Democratic Speaker of the House, saying she doesn't want to see President Trump impeached, at least not yet. Stick around, there's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks to the more than 2,400 members who contributed during our spring membership drive over the last week. You donated more than $440,000, and we're glad to welcome more than 500 new members to the WPR family. Thanks. Good to have you on board. Coming up, Governor Evers announced that the two new juvenile detention facilities that will replace Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake will be built in Outagamie and Milwaukee counties. We'll talk to a state assembly representative about his goals for the new facilities and how the plan might help families in his district. First, we take a look at some of the top stories in national politics. A broad anti-hate resolution has passed the U.S. House. The Democratic National Convention will be held in Milwaukee in 2020. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said this week she's against trying to impeach President Trump. And that's our question for you. How do you feel about Pelosi's opposition to impeachment proceedings? If you're a Democrat, are you upset by that stance, or do you think it's a good call? If you're a Republican or somewhere in the middle, what do you think? Do you think pursuing impeachment would be politically costly for Democrats? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. He's also the author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this anti-hate resolution passed in the U.S. House last week after a lot of twists and turns. It started focusing on anti-Semitism after tweets from Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar about the influence of a pro-Israel lobbying group. Untangle this one for us.
So this is actually the second resolution that has come after Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made two different comments. First of all, where there were comments on Twitter last month where she questioned the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, the AIPAC, which is one of the big lobbies here in D.C., suggesting that some politicians support Israel for money reasons. And, of course, that plays on some anti-Semitic tropes that that a lot of people were outraged about. Republicans forced a vote on an anti-Semitism resolution last month. Now, Ilhan Omar was speaking about that very controversy at a coffee shop here in Washington, D.C. It's actually one I pass on my commute home, where she's made a comment about how there are effectively dual loyalties, which is another anti-Semitic trope and one that that caused a lot of angst in Minnesota, not just in Minnesota, but also here in Washington. So members of Congress, Democrats in Congress, wanted to pass a resolution condemning anti-Semitism. They broadened that out, though, to include things like anti-Muslim sentiments after an exhibit in West Virginia compared Ilhan Omar to the September 11th terrorists. There were the resolution passed by an overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives, but it, you know, it's just another one of these moments where Democrats wanted to be talking about their agenda. They just took back control of the House of Representatives on the strength of a huge number of, you know, new young members. Ilhan Omar is only 37 years old. There are a lot of other members who are as young or younger than she is who have joined this Republican or the Democratic majority. And instead, their agenda has been derailed by things that cannot be described as anything other than a massive distraction.
23 Republicans ended up voting against the resolution. One voted present. I think Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin voted against it. Have we heard from any of those no votes about why they voted against it?
Yeah, the explanations ranged from the resolution got to be too broad and not focused on the actual incident that were, you know, Congressman Omar's tweets and comments. And then some other people, I'm blanking on who it was, but somebody said that he voted against it because it didn't have protections for, or it didn't express support for Caucasians and for Christians. So, you know, the sort of reasons for voting against varied, but they were mostly because the Republicans didn't feel that the Democratic measure or resolution really got to the heart of the matter.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at some of the top issues in national politics over the last week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi confirmed this week that she opposes the idea of starting impeachment proceedings against President Trump, saying he's, quote, just not worth it. What's been the reaction from her fellow Democrats to those comments?
Well, it looks like there are at least a couple of Republicans or a couple of Democrats who are still interested in pursuing impeachment. Congressman Jean Green from Texas, Congresswoman Rashid Tlaib from Detroit have said that they would introduce impeachment articles. But by and large, I think this is something that we're hearing from the majority of senior Democrats, the people who are, you know, in the position to hold impeachment hearings. Congressman Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee from New York has also sort of tapped the brakes on impeachment. And basically what everybody's waiting for right now is the Mueller report. You know, what is Robert Mueller actually going to say in his report, or what is the Attorney General going to say in his report on Robert Mueller's report, which is the first thing that we'll actually see if and when anything comes out. So, you know, at the end of the day, this is a conversation that Democrats are very leery of having because they see it as a hugely divisive issue. At a time when, you know, their presidential candidates are beginning their conversation about 2020, and that's not something that Democrats want to hand President Trump as the cudgel of, you know, look at these guys just coming after me nonstop. So Pelosi pumping the brakes is probably welcome news to about 95% of the Democrats in Congress, but to that other 5%, I mean, those are the people who go on MSNBC and CNN.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Green Bay. Anne, hello.
Hello. Well, I, as a Democrat, do not want to impeach Trump. I think he's one of the best things that's happened to the Democrat Party. And in Wisconsin, we had a recall of Scott Walker, which totally backfired and came back to bite us. So I would like things to stay as they are.
Anne, thanks for the call. A different process, but Anne's worried about a similar result if an impeachment effort happened and failed. She thinks it could bite Democrats come 2020.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the impeachment process, were it to happen today, would almost certainly fail. Not just, I mean, it may pass the House of Representatives, and therefore President Trump would be impeached. But remember, the Senate has to actually hold the trial and vote on removal, which is different from impeachment. And there are not the votes in a Republican-controlled Senate to impeach the president. It would be a moment in which Democrats would sort of be caught out as blocking the president or trying to remove him from office. And that could have ramifications, you know, not just for this moment in politics and for the 2020 elections, but in the long run, as Americans look at a president who was elected and a party that tried to remove him from office. You know, that's not something that goes away lightly, and it's something that history would remember.
And Anne hit on another point that I've been hearing out there, Reed, on the politics again of impeachment, the idea that President Trump in office might be helpful for Democrats. Running against him in some ways may have helped them in 2018. We can see probably a lot of House hearings on various aspects of the Trump campaign and Trump presidency that might, some Democrats might think, be better for them than an actual impeachment, successful or otherwise.
Yeah, and I've been talking to a lot of my Democratic friends around the city, some of whom are involved in sort of plotting the 2020 campaigns for various candidates. And, you know, a lot of them will say something to the effect of the corruption message that they hope to tie around President Trump can be effective, but it's not something that a lot of voters pay attention to. They don't see that their own party has figured out a way to talk about things like corruption until these investigations begin. And the hope is that that the investigations coming through the Judiciary Committee or the Government Oversight Committee will eventually lead to a narrative that Democrats can use in 2020.
We're talking to Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, about the week's top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think when you hear the word impeachment in current American politics? Good idea, bad idea? On the merits, do you think it's justified? Politically, who do you think it helps and hurts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, Democrats coming to Milwaukee next year. We'll look at some of the politics behind that. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, talking about some of this week's news in national politics. Couple more thoughts on the impeachment issue we've been talking about. We'll go to our callers again with Randy in Ripon. Randy, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I just find it odd that we impeached a president for telling one lie, which was Bill Clinton, and we got a president who sold over 8,700 lies in 2 years worth of time. And it just seems like a huge double standard. And like Bill Maher said, if we don't impeach him, where is the bar? I just seem so irresponsible to me.
Randy, thanks for the call, and specifically Reed, Bill Clinton, I believe, impeached in the House for obstruction of justice and perjury, lying under oath. Is there talk in Washington that, yeah, maybe Donald Trump has hit some standard like that, obstruction of justice or other crime that rises to the level of impeachment?
Yeah, there's talk of it, but it sort of matters about who's doing the talking. There are, you know, Congressman Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which is the committee where impeachment hearings would begin, has said that, you know, he would lay out a sort of a three-tiered system by which to figure out whether or not a president has done something that is impeachment-worthy. And it's a three-tiered system that actually came out of the Clinton impeachment. It begins with figuring out, you know, whether he has committed a crime, whether that crime rises to the level of impeachment. I mean, he's not going to get impeached over, you know, parking tickets or something like that. And then whether or not the impeachment could be seen. Oh, sorry about that. Something in my throat.
That's okay.
Whether or not the impeachment could be seen as sort of a nonpartisan investigation and then removal from office. You know, if the evidence points to something that is so bad that even Republicans say, yeah, okay, it's time to reach that level, then that is sort of the third tier. That's a pretty high bar, and that's why Speaker Pelosi is sort of backing off the notion that impeachment is coming anytime soon.
So we got another caller on impeachment before we move on. On to some issues close to home in Wisconsin. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with the last caller that there has to be some degree of impartiality and bipartisanship for the impeachment. What does bother me is like the recent revelation that Lisa Page said the Department of Justice halted Hillary Clinton's indictment for her scandal, yet we're now going to try to impeach the president for paying off some bimbos. I guess the real answer is, what is the correct way to go forward, and can't we get together and compromise and get along with each other to go forward?
Charlie, thanks for the call. The various issues they're talking about with President Trump include those payments, but also concerns about obstruction of justice. But Reed, the idea of a nonpartisan standard seems to not work so well in Congress these days on any issue, much less impeachment.
Yeah, and the fact is that President Trump is the single most polarizing figure in, I don't know, American political history. Is that too extreme to say? You know, the vast majority of Americans either absolutely love him or absolutely hate him. There is not much of a middle there, and that I think is one of the driving concerns the Democrats have. They don't want to be seen as engaging in partisan witch hunts. It didn't work well for the Republicans under President Obama, and it's not a look that Democrats want to embrace now.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. And this week, Wisconsin is one of the top stories in national politics. The Democratic Party said they're going to hold their 2020 national convention in Milwaukee. Here's party chairman Tom Perez speaking at the Fiserv Forum on Tuesday.
Where you hold a convention is a very strong statement of your values. It's a very strong statement of who we are as a party. And who and what we're fighting for.
All right, Reed, what do you see in this statement, in this choice of Milwaukee?
So I am a nonpartisan and objective journalist, but I am absolutely thrilled that we're doing this thing in Milwaukee as opposed to, you know, Houston and Miami are lovely cities, but it's a little hot in Houston in July. So Milwaukee, I hear, is wonderful in the summer. I'll look forward to being out there. I think this, what the Democrats' decision says, is that they are committed to rebuilding what's called the Blue Wall. The Blue Wall was the 18 states in the District of Columbia that voted for the Democratic presidential candidate in six consecutive presidential elections. And President Trump was the one who broke that blue wall in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. Wisconsin and Michigan. Pennsylvania wasn't a part of the blue wall. So if Democrats see their path back to the 270 electoral votes that they need, it goes through a state like Wisconsin. Wisconsin is going to be one of the most hotly contested targets for both sides come November. So I highly suggest that everybody, first of all, continue listening to NPR, and second of all, continue buy a DVR or something if you don't want to be overwhelmed by campaign advertisements. But this is, you know, this is the path back to 270, and it is not lost on Democrats that, you know, Hillary Clinton didn't show up in Wisconsin in 2016. They are certainly not making that mistake again, and putting the convention there tells me also that the Democrats see their path through those Great Lakes states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, as an easier path to 270 than they do maybe taking a moonshot and trying to win states in the Sun Belt like Texas, Arizona, and Georgia.
That said, holding your convention in a state doesn't mean you're going to win the state.
Very true. At least
a couple times in recent memory, Democrats and Republicans have both lost elections in states where they held their national convention.
Yeah, Democrats held their 2012 convention in Charlotte, and President Obama lost North Carolina. Republicans held their 2008 convention in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and John McCain lost Minnesota, although Minnesota has been trending towards ours in the last couple of years. So no guarantee, certainly, but it is, you know, this is the greatest moment that any political party has to show off their talent, their ideas. It's basically, you know, 4 days of free advertising. This is a time when Democrats have decided to bring that 4 days of free advertising straight to the heart of Wisconsin.
Later in the show, we're going to be asking our listeners to call in with what you think people should know about Milwaukee or Wisconsin when they travel here for that 2020 convention, what they should do, eat, where they should go. You can start now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Reed, another Wisconsin story that's getting national attention, apparently. I didn't really know this. You wrote about it. Our Wisconsin Supreme Court race, that's got some buzz nationwide.
Yeah, and I see this as an early test for the two parties as they try to engage in Wisconsin. You know, Democrats had a really successful year in 2018. Obviously, you know, Governor Evers knocked off Scott Walker, and Democrats won the Attorney General's race and a bunch of other contests, as well as that Supreme Court race that you had last year. Now, is that energy that Democrats had in 2018 going to continue into 2019 and eventually 2020, or will Democrats say, well, we won back the House, we'll rest on our laurels, and they might not turn out at greater rates. The interesting thing, the sort of the long-term prospect here is that Democrats and Republicans have the opportunity to solidify their respective majority on the state Supreme Court. Now, of course, these are technically nonpartisan elections, but they're nonpartisan in name only. That's kind of a joke. And the fact is that there are four conservatives and three liberals on the state Supreme Court now. This race is a race to replace one of the three liberals, Justice Abramson. And next year there will be a race to decide the fate of Justice Kelly, one of the conservative members of the court. So if the Democrats win this year, they have an opportunity that at that 4-3 deficit right now to win back effectively control of the state Supreme Court next year, when the election will take place on the same day that Democrats go to the polls to pick their presidential nominee. That sounds like a real big turnout driver to me, and it means that effectively control of the court is at stake this year, and then once again next year. You know, if Republicans win this year, they'll solidify that 4-3 majority no matter what happens next year. And bottom line, you know, the big fights this decade were all about, you know, Act 10 and Scott Walker's union-shaping legislation, and next decade, the big fights are all going to be about redistricting. Democrats say that the state is badly gerrymandered, that violates their constitutional rights. You know, a 4-3 liberal majority on the court would have something to say about that.
We have invited both of the state Supreme Court candidates, by the way, to join us next week on Central Time. We've extended those invitations. Hope to hear from them both. And before we let you go, Reed, we'll leave Wisconsin reluctantly and go back to the U.S. Senate. They're scheduled to vote on this resolution already passed by the House aimed at blocking President Trump's national emergency declaration for border wall funding. There's some late drama. What's going on there?
Well, there are more and more Republicans who are signing on. At least five Republicans have said publicly that they will vote against President Trump's declaration of an emergency. And it runs the gamut from, you know, the two blue state Republicans, Cory Gardner from Colorado, Susan Collins from Maine, to the much more conservative sort of libertarian wing of the party, Rand Paul from Kentucky, Mike Lee from Utah. They all say that, you know, the president is not justified in making this decision. There were some last-minute negotiations to try to tone down the emergency resolution or something like that. Those fell apart earlier today, and if President Trump loses this vote, he'll be forced to veto it in order to preserve his emergency declaration. That's still a pretty embarrassing vote to lose, especially when your party controls the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, this late scramble to come up with an idea to say, okay, we're not going to try to block the emergency declaration, but we promise in a month or so we're going to try to water down the power of presidents to have emergency declarations. That was a compromise some were aiming at.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a sort of the summation of a 50-year-long power bleed from Capitol Hill to the White House and straight down Pennsylvania Avenue. And Democrats Democrats and Republicans have both sort of allowed the president over time to acquire more and more power. When the president acquires more and more power, they get to do things like declare an emergency that Congress disapproves of. So I think, you know, at some point, whether it's now or in the very near future, I think you're going to see a real substantial move to claw back some power from the executive to the legislative branch and sort of rebalance that balance of power that's gotten seriously out of whack basically since Watergate.
And briefly, Reed, as we wrap up, is there thought that other Republican senators might join this effort now that there's not the pressure? They won't be the deciding vote since there are more than enough already?
Yeah, Rand Paul said that there are at least 10 Republican senators who are willing to vote against this. There are a number of senators who haven't weighed in yet. I'm not entirely certain that it'll get to 10, but certainly there are some members who are beginning to oppose the president. Now, that could be dangerous for their own reelection chances, especially in a Republican primary, because he is so popular among the Republican base. But, you know, that's just a part of sort of clawing back that authority for Congress.
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us.
You got it.
That's Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. He was with us to talk about some of the week's news out of Washington, D.C., and a little bit of Wisconsin news in there as well. You can still share your thoughts on the House Speaker opposing impeachment, Milwaukee getting into the 2020 convention, or any of the other stories we've been talking about. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. A video came out this week of U.S. Senator Mitt Romney from Utah celebrating his birthday with a Twinkie birthday cake with candles. Now, this isn't really a political story, even though there's a prominent politician at the center of it. What a lot of people paid attention to is how he blew out the candles. He, instead of blowing them all out at once, took one out of the Twinkie cake in his hand, blew it out, took another, blew it out. And again, not a political story, but if I was a politician, I would have flip-flopped like three or four times on this story since I saw the video. At first, I thought, what the heck? Who does that? Nobody does that. But then I thought about the times you're at a, you know, family kid's birthday party and the kid's got the sniffles and coughing, and then it's their turn to blow out the cake that you're about to eat. Well, now, if we had this other candle blowing out method, you wouldn't worry so much. And then, you know, if the candles burn too long, you can't get everybody together to sing happy birthday. What happens? Wax. Wax is dripping all over the frosting. That's not very appetizing either. I think I might be on board with this new model of candle blowing out. They didn't have one for every year. They only had a handful of candles in it. He explained later that he did, in fact, have a cold and didn't want to blow germs all over his Twinkie birthday cake. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.